Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, Sarah Werfel with Trescott Rossman, a former press secretary of Governor Snyder, will be joining us, kind of share her observations of the governor and how he's been doing on the public relations front. A little bit of her experience. She's got some great observations that I think you'll want to listen to. But first, guys, I wanted to make this first part of the podcast dedicated to addressing three fallacies that I think need to be corrected on the record about this gubernatorial campaign. And it's very easy to slip into these kind of things as the season comes about, where folks are making claims, they go uncontested, and then when they are contested, they become political in nature. But I think there are three things that I think are really subject to debate that have been kind of addressed as facts by particular candidates or PACs that I think we need to talk about. The first one is that Brian Calley, Lieutenant Governor, was an integral part or played some major role in crafting the Michigan business tax. And Jack, you and I were both reporters at the time, and Brian Calley's role in creating the Michigan business tax, I think in this campaign so far, has been grossly overstated. Is that a fair statement?
He was a freshman House member when the Democrats controlled the House. And what he did have is he did have a better understanding of the issue, I think, with his banking background than most people had.
And so he was tapped to go in there and just be the House Republican representative on a project where he was not setting the parameters. He was a bit player in a much bigger play.
And what he did was he saw where he could save some businesses money with some credits and make some changes. But you know how that works. You don't come in there and go, hey guys, make these changes, but make the bill better without saying also, and then you got my vote.
I mean, because if you're going to be an active part of the group, then you have to, in order to get with something out of it, you're going to have to be a yes vote. Because if you don't do anything and just be a no vote, then you weren't really contributing to the process.
Yeah. And also don't forget, the same bill got rid of the SBT, which was the big, terrible, horrible tax at the time that people had been complaining about for a long time. So if Brian Calley voted no on that bill, he could be accused of voting against getting rid of the SBT.
So Brian Calley, then, if you could say that he helped craft the MBT, which I guess you could say, but the context is wrong because he was in support of getting rid of the SBT. And then later, he was a major contributor in getting rid of the Michigan business tax just 3 or 4 years later.
And he was a major contributor in the sense that, again, he had more background in it. And I think you can make the argument that, yes, he probably did contribute an awful lot because he simply understands these kinds of things. And he was one of the governor's point men on putting the whole tax change together.
He was the point person for Governor Snyder in putting together the whole corporate income tax that we have now. And not only that, he was also a major contributor in getting rid of the personal property tax on manufacturing equipment, which I think we all thought couldn't really be done. But he was able to work it out and figure it out. So I guess I bring this up just because there are many things you can attack Brian Calley on and be 100% accurate. He did abandon Trump. He did make a dog's lunch out of that part-time legislature thing. He got a new screw-up now when he turned in signatures that weren't even his to the Secretary of State. That looks really bad and really pretty sloppy. But as far as it connects to this business tax thing, the record would show that he has done more to make it a business-friendly environment in Michigan for businesses than he has been as far as teaming up with Granholm to do some kind of assault on businesses. I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Yeah, that's a bad rap. And it was a bad rap the first time it was brought up. Remember, was when he was running for lieutenant governor and one of the other people that wanted, I can't recall the guy.
Was it Wes? Wes Nakagiri?
No. That may be who was behind it, but it was a businessman from the west
Cooper.
Side of the state. Yes.
It was Cooper.
Cooper is the first one who came up with this thing. You know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, literally takes 3 or 4 minutes to explain to a voter.
It took us 5 minutes.
Yes. So it's just sort of a cheap shot, but it's something that he really, it's a bum rap hitting him with that one.
It's not going to stop the shooty super PAC from continuing to use it, but I think that it has to be said that trying to make that a negative is really kind of a bum deal for him. Okay, second fallacy of this campaign, that Abdul El-Sayed is in the clear as it relates to his ability to get on the ballot in 2018. Jack, he is not in the clear yet. There is still a challenge period where another candidate can come in and challenge his ability to be on the ballot. What that court did was say that the Secretary of State did not have standing to bring forward anything because they didn't see anything wrong. The Secretary of State has said all along they thought that it was fine for Abdul el-Sayed to be on the ballot. That's not the question. The question is new ground that would have to be broken here. Nobody has ever challenged a political candidate in this way to say that if you were registered in another state while your registration here in Michigan was still kind of in this legal limbo kind of area, that period of time cannot be counted as you being an official resident of the state of Michigan as it relates to law, Jacob. So I think that Sri Tanadar is really the only candidate who has any vested interest in making sure Abdul stays off the ballot. And I think he still has a chance to make that case.
Yeah, I mean, and so what you're saying here is obviously there needs to be an antagonist, right? Someone who needs to step up and want to challenge this. And, you know, the case could be for Sri, because if he wants to make this claim as being the most progressive candidate, you can make the argument that he needs to get the other person who is most associated with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party off the ballot. So certainly there is an incentive, some would believe, for Sri to take this active step in trying to challenge Abdul's signatures with the chance that it can kind of clear him out of the way and have it be how Sri has been talking about, how he believes and wants it to be a two-person race between him and Gretchen Whitmer.
Well, and let's take a look at it from Gretchen's standpoint. She wants Abdul el-Sayed in the race because, as you said, that takes votes away from Sri, theoretically. Is Bill Cobbs going to make the ballot? We don't even know if he's going to make the ballot. So, and even if he does, he would rather, I think, see that progressive wing split up as well. I don't think the Republicans are going to challenge it because the Republicans want to have Abdul el-Sayed in the race just so they can chop up more votes. And then there's another voice attacking Gretchen Whitmer. And if Abdul wins, great. They would rather run against Abdul than Gretchen Whitmer anyway. So Sri is the only person who benefits by Abdul not being on the ballot.
Yeah, it's either Sri or some, you know, do good person out there who's like, this is not right. I believe that Abdul is not qualified to run, and it would be a sham if he were on the ballot. But in all honesty, I mean, it looks like Sri is in the position to kind of make this happen if he wants to.
So, Jack, I want to ask you this, and I know that Sri is struggling with this question. Should he do this? Because I think there's a concern that if he goes ahead and challenges Abdul, he's going to run crossways with folks in the progressive movement who are going to come after him and say, what the heck are you doing? We like this guy. Screw you. We're going to now devote all of our energy to Gretchen to get you to lose.
I don't know if you let something like that prevent you from doing something that you think is going to actually leave you with a better field and a better chance of winning. I suspect you go ahead and you challenge them. If you do the evaluation and you say, look, this is my best chance of winning, I suspect, especially when you have the money to spend, I would think that it's something he'd go ahead and he'd pursue.
That's an interesting ripple effect you brought up, Kyle. The one thing I thought about in trying to think of cons is, what if Sri puts himself out there and challenges Abdul's signatures or his eligibility, and his eligibility is confirmed? Well, now he's there for sure. Like, the question has been settled. Mm. And so is there a benefit, along with what you talked about with Gretchen Whitmer and the Republicans, of just leaving this out there as an unanswered question? I mean, is there a fear that confirming his eligibility will do no good for Sri?
That's an interesting point, that maybe the fact that it's out there and it's still an open question helps Sri just as much. But I don't know how many people pay attention to that. I mean, we all care. I mean, I think we're interested. And if you're a progressive who's just like completely dialed in to this whole debate, you would know. But the general public who's basing their votes on TV commercials, I don't know if they know. And so, Jack, that comes back to your point there. If you get Abdul out of the race and now you're the only other person who's really running against Gretchen Whitmer, and it's a one-on-one battle.
If you play it the right way, that you're the guy who said, hey, look, this guy's not eligible, and then it turned out they're not eligible. If it plays out that way for Sri, I'm not sure it hurts him with the progressives.
Because they weren't going to vote for him anyway?
Well, no, just because the bottom line is all you did is you prevented somebody from getting closer to the ballot who was going to be, you have to play it that way, who was going to be declared ineligible anyhow. So in that way, I don't think you're necessarily taking responsibility if you can play it that way and have the progressives blame you. You're simply calling the guy out ahead of time before what was going to happen anyhow.
That's a good point. You could say, listen, I'm just trying to do the voters a favor just to make sure that everything's on the up and up, that he is eligible to run, and if he's not, then this court was going to make a decision. But until there's an aggressor here, unless there's somebody who's claiming to be aggrieved and actually claiming that Abdul shouldn't be on the ballot, he is not in the clear, so that's the second fallacy I wanted to eliminate here. Third fallacy, Sri Tanadar, the most progressive candidate in the field. I don't know if you can really say that.
Well, he's basing it on, you know, being the only one that, supposedly the only one who voted for Bernie Sanders. And I don't know how much more you need. I suppose somebody could do a litmus test and send him some questions. Where's your position on this, this, and this? But at this stage of the game, probably just being able to claim it because of the vote is probably okay for the time being.
Having watched these forums with Abdul and all the other different Democratic gubernatorial candidates, I can't think of one instance where Sri Tanadar was to the left of Abdul al-Sayed. I don't know if there's one issue.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at these his campaign videos, I think maybe you have to debate if he is the most. I mean, I think there are some policies he's pushing that you would consider progressive. I mean, I don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, if anyone's come out and said, I want to ban for-profit charter schools, you know, completely kind of thing. So I think the issue with Sri is that I think, you know, some of his policies are progressive in nature, but I think where he's getting that flack from the progressive wing of the Democrats is that they're just not buying it. Like it's
coming from the heart.
It's on paper. He's taken all the right positions, but they want to know if he's been their champion since the beginning. And then there's all this talk about the things that happened last year where he was maybe considering running as a Republican. So that's being used against him for sure. You know, I just don't think he's bought that legitimacy with the progressive wing. I think how Abdul speaks and acts and moves, he seems to have won people over in that way. But with Sri just saying he's progressive and putting forth these policies, it doesn't seem like that's been enough to establish him as legitimate in that way.
It seems like Abdul comes from a progressive background and now he wants to take those ideas and be governor, whereas Sri wants to be governor and sees these progressive policies as a way to get to be governor.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure he's wrong in doing that. I think that makes a lot of sense. We're in the Beltway here and we do see things very differently than the rest of the state. I still am always amazed that people talk about, well, look, this guy named Rick Snyder, who was actually a moderate, came in. Nobody thought he was going to win the primary back in 2010. Well, the reality was he was known as a moderate by the news media and by the people in the Beltway, not the average person out there who was voting, because he ended up being the one who got most of the Tea Party votes. They just saw him as an outsider. So all of that stuff that everybody was progressive was talking about and everything else at the time about how the race was unfolding, quite frankly, and maybe to some extent us included, we were kind of on the wrong page.
I guess it's also all about how effective your marketing is, right? And as of right now, Sri's done a fantastic job with the marketing of himself. So he can claim himself the most progressive all day, and if he says it loud enough and a lot of times, people are just going to believe it. Just like with marketing any product, right? I mean, you can claim that Miller Lite is the best light beer out there. You know, less filling tastes great. And you might think that Miller Lite tastes like piss, but they've said less filling tastes great so many times that that's what we think. And it does taste great because they've said it.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And I think that leads into another thing that it's going to be is being used as a strike against Sri, especially by Abdul, who will want to claim that he is the most progressive, is that Sri is able to kind of buy this influence. I mean, he's not trying to excuse that. And so, but, you know, Abdul will argue part of being a progressive is not being tied to corporations, to PACs, to buying your own election with your own wealth. So I think that will be used against him. But as you pointed out, like, if Sri has the power to kind of put this message out there, is already proving to have sway with voters.
And for the record, I don't think Miller Lite tastes like piss. It may taste more like water. And I actually kind of like it. But anyway, I think you guys get
it. Is it really less filling?
Yeah, it is actually less filling because I can have a couple of them and feel just fine, whereas maybe a different beer, I have one and I'm good to go.
Well, I wouldn't know.
Yeah, I know. You haven't had beer in a while.
Is Miller Lite our next podcast sponsor here? They're going to be calling us soon.
We'll find out. The podcast sponsored by Miller Lite. I don't know. Do they subscribe? I'll have to ask John if they subscribe. So let's move on here to our guest here with Sarah Wolfe. Joining us this week for the podcast is Sarah Werfel. She is with Truscott Rossman. Thanks for joining us.
You bet, Murs team.
So, Sarah, obviously, when you came back from Oregon, you came back to be the press secretary for Governor Snyder. Now, what appealed you to that? What drew you to come back to Michigan, your home state, to be the press secretary for the governor?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know, we'd been gone for 6 years and had left at a time when, you know, Michigan was really struggling. Most of our families were still back in the state. My husband's family had a small business. You really saw the challenges they'd gone through, some of the challenges with jobs leaving and unemployment that my dad struggled with up in the Upper Peninsula. And it was always there. And then, of course, how challenged Detroit was with the Kwame scandal at the time. Even living out in the Pacific Northwest, our friends would be like, oh, that state, aren't you glad you left? It's so messed up. And I'd be like, no, it's not like that. You don't understand. And right. I think, you know, for a lot of us at the time, you know, Rick Snyder spoke to a different approach. And that whole no blame, no credit, getting things done, focused on the right answers, I think, and just not that hyper-partisan, but a pragmatic approach was something that just really spoke to me.
So when you came back and you were the governor's press secretary, what was kind of the first things you felt like you had to work with him on? Where was his areas that he needed to improve?
Well, I'd say overall, it's just first, when anytime you're speaking on behalf of somebody, it's really getting to know them and anticipate kind of how they speak, what's authentic to them, right? And I think generally speaking of just this non-attack approach was where I was generally philosophically anyways. It's about trying to be positive and forward-looking. So that was a natural connection. But then it's really getting to know somebody and kind of what their quirks are, what their pet peeves are, how they really like to communicate. And then, of course, being able to connect with people and deliver a message.
Now, I seem to remember first covering him, he was very nervous. He seemed very nervous in front of the press. Is that a fair analysis?
I would say, I think just in a matter of comfort levels, right? I think his natural affinity is more of a Q&A, kind of that give and take question and answer, but not necessarily when I think a lot of times it's in that scrum format where everybody's kind of clustered around you with that personal space issue. I think just being able to be comfort with that is a big step for anybody. And just knowing that you're going to have people swarming around you and get used to it. Or from a standpoint of this is just, it is, and I think there was always understanding. The one thing I always appreciated about Governor Snyder was the fact that there was a recognition that the media played an important role in being accessible was important. As much as it might not be a natural affinity for the first thing that you wanted to do, but it was at least underlying.
Did he appreciate that?
From a standpoint of?
That the media has a job and it is important to communicate to the media because they're the conduit to the public.
Yeah, I absolutely do believe that. I think overall, especially from the time of being able to make the case, because I think one of Rick Snyder's strongest points, but also sometimes a challenge, is this absolute undying belief that as long as he can make the rational case for something, everybody will understand it and come to the side. And I think a lot of times when you're working on so many major public policy issues that have almost been the third rail of Michigan politics for so long, first of all, it's all that changed so fast, and then in its way, being able to talk about it in a way that people can understand and hopefully end up supporting.
So if, as long as you make the smart decisions and you make the rational argument, you should be okay. That doesn't work sometimes in politics, though.
No, and I think that's obviously a challenge, especially in this political landscape overall. I think that has just gotten more challenging over time, especially if you saw the 2016 election and how far we've come and devolved almost since then. You'd like to think, hey, if I just can use the facts and make a case, build the case, everybody will kind of, you know, get there. And there are always, you know, everybody says you're always entitled to your opinion, but my fact, you know, not your own set of facts.
Right.
I think that's becoming more and more challenging. So I think that's opened up the way for both challenges on both the Republican and Democratic side to criticize the governor.
So it seems like he's kind of stepped into some public relations problems. And I'm thinking most recently here where he discontinued the water distribution in Flint, and then we had Line 5, and then we had the Nestle situation. And so all of these water things kind of mixed together at the same time, kind of creating a major perception problem. Why does that happen to him? This isn't the first time it happened. Why do these things happen to him?
All right. So, and I think that is the combination of a perfect storm, right? When you have all of those water issues that all kind of come together at the forefront. And I think sometimes it's just the nature of where things progressed in policy, but it's also necessarily trying to work on a timeline and being as strategic as possible of how those things all come together at the same time and realizing that sequencing is usually pretty important.
Yeah. How has he done as far as public relations from when you started with him to now he's going to be out of office here in about 8 months or so? How has he progressed or regressed?
Well, I'd certainly say being able to be so good on his feet and being able to, I think you'll find a lot of times where it's pretty rare anymore, I think, sometimes, although you almost see a trend more towards that now of not actually speaking from detailed prepared remarks. That's just not the Governor Snyder way. It's having a couple of key points and a bullet, and I think he's on his best when he's actually being able to do questions and answers.
As far as accessibility, we've found anyway in the media here that he isn't as accessible as he has been. Do you think it's because he's gotten burned so bad with the Flint water crisis that maybe he's just kind of over it and he doesn't really see the need to have to talk as much?
Well, I'd say definitely it's one of those things that you've heard over time. I mean, because one of the things I most appreciated working for him was, again, that understanding of the role that media played in. You know, unless there was a scheduling issue, it was something that was always tried to be built in, was that kind of at least quick media availability time. It was more to be able to, you know, kind of talk about the issues at hand and then also, you know, obviously the other stuff that pops up along the way. And I certainly think some of the challenges that have popped up over the last 2 years would probably have added to that decision.
How do you think he's going to be best remembered? How do you hope, and why don't we do it this way? What do you hope Snyder will be remembered as 10, 20 years from now, and how do you think he will be?
Two things. One of them is the comeback state. I know it gets overused sometimes, but I truly believe that Michigan is a better place overall from some of the major public policy that Governor Snyder has been able to enact. The second thing is something that I think is just way too missing, especially in today's climate, which is this relentless positive action. I know sometimes you can roll your eyes on that, but this whole mantra of civility in politics, in being able to handle yourself in a way that doesn't have to criticize other people or take them to task, and find ways that you can get people to work together to find the things that you agree on versus what you disagree on. I think that's one of the things that we can hopefully, the pendulum swings back again, and we realize how much that civil discourse matters in today's tough issues that still face the state and the country.
Maybe there's kind of a void, or there had been a void for so long to have the top Republican in the state not throwing bombs. And maybe that's why we're seeing the Attorney General and the Lieutenant Governor's super PAC making up for time lost here, because he never has been and probably never will be one to throw partisan bombs.
Nope. And I think, you know, and that's, if you look back at the time, I think that is one of the challenges, is that some of the kind of the, you know, the quintessential Rick Snyder sayings of dog years and just moving so fast and no blame and no credit. Those also bring in some challenges sometimes, because you're usually moving so hard so fast to really doing the due diligence to make sure that you can reflect on what's been done and being able to talk about it. And then also the no blame, no credit, which is fantastic and something I hope we can all aspire to. But the reality of it is then you still have to have people on the ground, your stakeholders, if you will, folks who are willing to actually help also do that part where they can actually help toot a horn or actually push back and actually talk about all the downsides or the negatives of something that might be happening too.
Do you see, you talked about, you know, him wanting, knowing the importance of the media and things like that. Mm-hmm. And for some of us who have been in these scrums with the governor, we know that there's just some things he won't comment on. For example, I understand like litigation, but it seems like the governor more often than not will not get engaged with whatever the hot bills are in the legislature. Can that be seen as an accessibility issue, or is there like a greater good that he's trying to accomplish and maybe not trying to get himself involved with legislative things?
Well, I think you probably, part of my answer is going to be the last part of what you just alluded to, was I think just overall challenge-wise, just as you kind of get to the end of a term and some of the tension that exists, I would say, both legislatively and administratively as you push on those things, I think there's just a recognition that he feels some things are better left to that conversation that he can be had more one-on-one or in a group setting versus kind of airing it publicly, if you will.
Do you think you're ever going to have a job that was more time-consuming and demanding than press secretary for a governor?
It is hard to imagine sometimes. I think, you know, primarily when you look back at that first, the first 4 years, and something that's never ended is there was just, it was kind of a nonstop whirlwind. Constantly a challenge, but also, you know, a pretty rewarding opportunity.
Saturdays, Sundays, how many hours a week would you say you put in? Because I know you've thought about this. How many hours a week did you put in?
Do you know, I honestly, I have to say, so now I'm in a position where we count billable hours, right? Where we have to track our time by every 15-minute increment. I can't even begin to know what it would be if I had done that the first 5 years working in the gubernatorial administration, because just that type of role is one that where you need to be accessible pretty much 24/7. There were often times where, you know, the phone would ring or I would get calls or emails or direct messages on Twitter up until at least 11 o'clock at night. And then they would start again kind of during the talk radio shows, you know, starting in between. It usually waited until at least 6 a.m. But then they would start up afterwards, you know. So I think it was just a matter of, and there's always that push-pull of making sure you're being responsive and accessible. And I know that was something that was always an ongoing challenge.
So you get a reprieve from like 11 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Yes.
So that's enough time, right?
Yeah, right?
you can get some good sleep in that time. What more do you need?
Right? So if you'd done been able to do billable hours back then, you wouldn't have to work now, right? Is that what you're trying to say?
I don't know that I'd go that far. But I'd say that they're from a time hour-wise, I wouldn't even know how many hours a week. And they certainly went with ebbs and flows, right?
Sure.
Of the issues of the day and the time. But overall, yeah, I can't even think of what that would be with 15-minute increments right now.
Sarah Werfel with Trescott Rossman, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate you taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Sarah for stopping in, Jack and Jacob. And it's interesting to know that we don't have, actually, Miller Lite here. We still have some remnants of a 24-pack that was brought to us by a friend, don't we? Is that still back in the crypt?
Oh, the Labatts?
Yeah, the Labatts. Is that still in the crypt?
We'll have to go check. We bring those out after a long day of covering elections, usually.
Yeah, right. We start chilling them about 8, 9 o'clock, and so that by midnight or 1 o'clock when we're done, we can pop them open.
Yeah, it's that weird thing where you want to pop it open at the end, but then you're also like, well, it's like 2 in the morning. We should probably go home now.
Well, you can do an experiment where you drink the beer before you do the addition and see if people notice that one addition is a little different than the rest.
I think we did that one time, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we did do that one addition where we were drinking while we were doing it. I don't know how that worked out.
I don't know. I think it just took a little more editing effort on your part to kind of weed through all the additional typos and things.
I think we just made sure the proofer wasn't invited to the party. But we did that one time several years ago, and I don't think we'll do it again.
No, it doesn't seem like that's coming back again.
No, it was a good idea at the time.
This was really exciting.
It makes the work seem easy. You do just as well until you look at it the next day.
All right, well, that's going to do it. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.